This is NPR Illinois. I'm Jamie Dunn. The state constitution turns 45 next week. As the document nears its birthday, Illinois Issues columnist Charlie Wheeler looks at the many ways it modernized government. I sat down with Charlie to talk about his column.
You covered the constitutional convention that produced the 1970 Constitution when you were a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. Can you tell us a little bit about what led up to it and why a new constitution was drafted?
There had been a lot of concern over the years that the 1870 Constitution was outmoded, crafted at a time when Illinois was still largely a rural state. There were a lot of restrictions put in there that reflected concerns of the time that were no longer applicable and some things that were just totally irrelevant. And the thinking had been for a long time, we need to do something to revise the Constitution. And so ultimately, the two major political parties in the General Assembly asked voters in a referendum of 1968, should we have a convention? And the referendum was approved overwhelmingly. And as a result, delegates were elected in 1969, and the convention began its deliberations actually in December of 69, wound up in September of 70, and in mid-December of 1970, voters ratified the new Constitution.
Your column focuses on three aspects of the Constitution: making the government more efficient, clarifying the separation of the branches of government, and promoting ethical behavior. Let's start with the first. What's one key thing the document did to make government more efficient?
Under the old Constitution, there were very severe limitations on the ability of general units of government, cities, counties, the state itself, to borrow money for capital projects without going to the voters. And that may have worked well in the 1800s, but now we're in the 20th century. We have needs for sewage treatment plants. We have needs for roads. And so at the state level, we went to the fiction of creating special quasi-public bodies that would sell bonds. And on the local government level, the restrictions meant that for cities and counties that needed to provide a service, they didn't have the ability to borrow the money. They didn't have enough cash on hand for a major capital improvement. And so they created a special district. So we have sanitary districts. We have library districts. We have park districts. We actually have more units of local government with taxing authority than any state in the nation.
And how did the Constitution seek to promote more ethical behavior?
In the years leading up to the Constitution, there were a number of scandals. One of the more prominent ones involved a couple of Supreme Court justices who acquired stock in a bank in which a litigant before the court was a principal. He was the general counsel. And as it turned out, the stock was either given to them as gifts or was sold to them on the cheap, depending on whose story you want to believe, at a time when the case was pending before the court. It had to do with criminal charges brought against this individual. They'd been dismissed by the circuit court. The prosecution appealed. It was before the Supreme Court. So shortly after receiving this gift of stock, the Supreme Court, in an opinion written by one of the justices who got the stock, upheld the dismissal of the charges. Well, when this came out, there was a lot of consternation, and one of the things that the new Constitution provided was that public officials and candidates for office have to file audited statements of economic interest. The idea was that people would not be able to secretly hold stock and then vote in what might appear to be a conflict of interest. Now, as anybody who's actually looked at these economic interest statements knows, they really don't tell you much. The ones that I review back in my days as a reporter, I would say 95% of the answers were none, not applicable, none of the above, that kind of thing.
What do you see as the single most important change that was made in the 1970 Constitution?
I think one of the significant changes was the grant of home rule authority to local governments, cities with a population of 25,000 more, or counties that elected their chief executive officer and chose to be home rule. There was also the opportunity for smaller communities for voters to vote themselves into home rule. It put local managers more in control of their own situation. Local governments under the old Constitution operated under something called Dillon's Rule, which referred to a court decision that in essence said local governments can't do anything unless they have the specific authorization of the General Assembly. And so the classic example used in arguing for the home rule provision was that when the city of Chicago wanted to change the color of the lights on its squad cars, it had to come down to the legislature and have a bill introduced, passed, signed into law to allow it to do that.
So then on the flip side of that question, what do you think was perhaps the biggest error or omission that the drafters made?
The 1970 Constitution gives great powers to the executive branch. The governor has the power through executive order to reorganize agencies, subject to a veto from the General Assembly. The governor has powers to rewrite legislation if the General Assembly sends it to him. And that, in retrospect, may have been, I don't know if a mistake is the right word, but I think the way it's been exercised by governors since that time exceeded what I thought at the time the delegates intended to do. And I say that because in the debate talking about this amendatory veto, as it's called, the argument was that sometimes legislation will reach the governor's desk and it's got some little problem with it, kind of like typo type of error. There's a section that's misnumbered. Under the 1870 Constitution, the governor would have no choice but to absolutely veto the bill totally, and the legislature would have to start from scratch. And so the discussion at the time was there should be a way for a governor to correct these kind of technical errors. Well, governors decided to use it very broadly. For example, when the General Assembly, after much deliberation and compromise and negotiation, finally passed a concealed carry law, Governor Quinn used his amendatory veto to add provisions outlawing certain types of weapon, outlawing high-capacity magazines. The General Assembly overrode him, but in the scheme of things, in my mind, that went beyond what the intent of the framers was.
There has been a lot of recent focus on the pension protection in the Constitution. What are your thoughts?
In our current climate, with the fiscal problems the state faces, there's been a lot of criticism of a provision in the Constitution that says that membership in any public employee retirement system is a contractual relationship, the benefits of which shall not be impaired or diminished. And the argument has been made that that unfairly ties the hand of the General Assembly. We now have a problem because for probably close to 100 years or more, we've not properly funded the pensions, and so we have this huge outstanding liability, more than $100 billion. And to try and deal with that, the legislature proposed reducing benefits, and it was thrown out by the Supreme Court. And I think the court has clearly said the provision says you can't cut benefits, and there's been a lot of criticism of it. But on the other hand, I would argue that the delegates knew what they were doing, and the Constitution is working exactly as how they expected it to. Because at the time, there was concern that if we do give local governments home rule, what's to stop them from suddenly saying, we're no longer going to pay pensions for police or firefighters? And that was where the pressure came from to put the pension protection clause in there. State employees weren't unionized. This was before the collective bargaining law that was enacted a decade or so later. And in fact, back at the time, a group of senior lawmakers on a commission that oversaw pensions sent a message to the delegates sponsoring this provision saying, you know, if this goes in the Constitution, we won't be able to cut benefits in the future. And the response was, well, yeah, that's what it's all about.
You can read Wheeler's column for Illinois Issues at our website, wuis.org.